Hi, everyone, and welcome to Sped Homeschool Conversations. This is our weekly broadcast put on by Sped Homeschool, and we are a nonprofit that helps parents homeschool children with special educational needs. And so every week we are live with a very special guest, as we are tonight, talking about different topics. And tonight our topic is teaching reading comprehension for academic success. And it's part of our month-long series on reading and reading remediation and helping you. If you've got students who are stuck, what are some ways that you can kind of work through those issues? And our very special guest is Dr. Marion Blank. And she is a world-renowned literacy and language expert who developed and served as the co-director of Columbia University's Developmental Neuropsychology Program for Autism and Related Disorders. And I know she has at least two reading programs. Both of them are partners with our organization, both Reading Kingdom and ASD Reading, as well as I know she's written quite a few books. I know a few of them were mentioned even in just the scroll of some of the viewers that were going to be joining us tonight. They say, oh yeah, I have a couple of her books. So they're going to be joining us. Just know that if you are joining us live, we would love you to be part of our conversation. And so put your comments and your questions in the feed and join us as we talk about reading comprehension. So welcome, Dr. Mary Blank, and thank you for taking time out of your schedule to just talk to us about reading comprehension.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, I told you, I said the first question I'm going to ask you is, why are you passionate about this topic? I'd love to know more about that.
It's an interesting question. Literacy has played a tremendous role in my life since I was a child. I first was struck by it when I was about in kindergarten. I was learning to read and write, and I noticed that there were a number of my relatives who couldn't read or write. And they had come from Eastern Europe without any, pre-post-war and pre-war World War I. Schooling wasn't part of their life. And I remember once seeing an uncle whom I really loved, and he wrote an X on a paper. And then my father wrote under his X my father's name and his signature. And I said to my father, why are you doing that? And he says, well, Jack can't read or write. So I have to, when someone can't, we have to do this. You never see this today. But years ago, it was quite common. And I was shocked by it. And what happened was my grandmother, whom I really dearly and deeply love, was illiterate. She had come over as a teenager. She had to work endlessly. She had six or seven children very early. It was a really tough life. So I told her I was going to teach her to read and write, and she was very kind to me, and she let me. Unfortunately, she got ill soon after, and we couldn't continue. But I really started on my path then, and it's never left me. And it's one of the things, it's so painful for a person who can't read and write, and that pain is just not registered. People don't recognize it. And the I've heard some amazing stories. Sometimes when I'm on a plane, a man will sit down next to me and say, especially years ago, when women weren't doing that much business, they sort of look at me, why are you on this business flight? You know, kind of. And then they'd say, are you a teacher? So I didn't want to get them all riled up and say I was a professor or anything. So I said, yeah, I'm a teacher. And then they just opened up, and several of them told me they were massively dyslexic and could not read. And they were heads of companies. And I said, how do you manage this? And we have very good secretarial assistants. They do it all. So they cover it up. And it's really terrible to see people deprived of one of the most valuable skills in life.
Right. And it covers every aspect of your life. And that's why it's so important. If we have the ability to help others and our children that we homeschool, just different techniques that we're going to talk about tonight. And I'm excited to hear what you have to share. We have a comment from one of our watchers. She says, hi, I'm excited to be listening live. I have the ASD language book, and I've worked with both my boys with it.
Oh, that's lovely to hear.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us, Nijis. So also, I want to let you all know that this episode is sponsored by one of our other partners, Bookshark, and they're sponsoring this episode, and we'll find out more about their curriculum as well. And that, as we dive in this, in our midsection of this interview. But as we get going, reading comprehension. Why is reading comprehension so essential to academic success? Since that's kind of the title of our show tonight. Sure. How does that all tie in together?
Well, it's so strange. The whole field of reading is so poorly explained and examined in the general population, and that's a tragedy. For example, the word writing covers everything from writing a single letter to writing your alphabet to yes. writing compositions, to writing essays, to writing mm-hmm. the Constitution. Definitely need more terms. There was an old joke, you know, shoemaker's child has no shoes. And mm-hmm. so you'd expect a language rich area like reading to have good definitions, and they have terrible definitions. Mm-hmm. And the issue of comprehension is basically, is the child understanding the message, or the reader understanding the message of the text? Mm-hmm. And that's the purpose of reading. The purpose of reading is not decoding, which gets so much attention. Decoding is, okay, there's the letters C-A-T, that means cat. So you've decoded mm-hmm. it from print to speech. Mm-hmm. You've got to do it in reading, but there are several types. There's one type of child, often they're autistic, called hyperlexics. They can't really speak well. They have very poor use of language, and they can read anything. The first hyperlexic that I saw like that was a 4-year-old boy from Korea, and he was reading the New York Times, not understanding a word, but loving to read it. And then there are actually a group of learning disabled children called word callers who are also very good at decoding, but they don't understand what they read. And what you hear them do is read a word at a time as they go down the page. And you can hear in their voice that they don't know what they're reading, but right. they can read well. So decoding is a skill that you need for reading, but it mm-hmm. isn't the essence of reading. Comprehension is the essence of reading. Mm-hmm. Now, what people don't realize, and it doesn't get, in fact, well, I'll step back a little. About actually 40 years ago, this was a big talk I gave in the Midwest, and I talked about, we were talking about just this issue, and I said, the children who are failing do not understand the language of literacy. And people looked at me as if I were crazy. They said, what are you talking about? That has now become somewhat familiar to people, which is very good, because written language is very different from spoken language. And one of the big mistakes of the whole language movement was to say language is language, and if children learn spoken language, well, they'll learn written language. The two systems are very different.
Yes.
And so that being sort of doing a quick and dirty assessment, the language of everyday life can readily be described as the language of the here and now. Mm-hmm. Joey comes to dinner. Oh, look, it's raining. And I didn't water the plants and whatever. Right. And so there's a lot of, which is very useful. There's nothing wrong with it. It's necessary for life, but it's mm-hmm. the language that allows you to just cope with everyday existence.
Yes.
That's the language children hear for the most part. The language of books is totally different. It's the language of the there and then. So there's a lot of use, for example, of past tense. There's a lot of use of complex sentences. So even a book like, you know, Wind in the Willows will say, you know, whatever the animal is, you know, they'll say he was so befuddled by what all that was going on. And if a child is read to regularly, and many children are, they pick this up, and it's the greatest way of introducing them to the language of literacy. But many, many children are not read to regularly. the stress lives of people today, with women working, with needing double incomes and so, children don't get the time and attention that they used to in this realm. And the number of kids being, and plus they love devices. So the parents who are super busy sort of say, oh, good, look, he's playing with the phone, that's great, or he's playing with his iPad, isn't that wonderful? And so the kids are not getting the language, the spoken language that represents the language of literacy.
Right, because even in videos, that is the here and now language that they're hearing, because it's conversation. The images portray the rest of the things that a book would normally portray.
Yeah. Well, you raise a really interesting idea, because I love using videos for actually teaching the language of literacy quickly to children who don't have it.
Right.
Because if you structure the material well, you can impose a system on the video that sort of, it's like a scaffold that allows the children to immediately see, very quickly see, what's going on. So, for example, there's a wonderful film, I don't know if you're familiar with it, called The Bear. It's about a little bear who becomes orphaned in the wild, and he has to survive. And he survived by linking himself to a male bear who doesn't want anything to do with him. And it's a very interesting story. Now, it's also wordless, which is really, I love wordless books and I love wordless movies, where you, what I do, and the kids love it, is you show a short segment, teach them how to summarize it, which is a very key comprehension skill. Right. And you don't teach them how to summarize. We'll come back to this again. You don't teach them how to summarize by asking questions. Questions are a very poor form of instruction that we've overused. Well, I'll come back to. And what happens is I have the children making notes over, let's say, a segment that takes maybe 10 minutes altogether. We break it up into, let's say, 4 or 5 segments. And then they look at their notes. Give me the summary as they're looking at the note, but in good language, the kind of language you use in writing. And then you take it away and say, now tell it to me again. So now they're doing it from memory. And it's as if they read a book. And then you can ask them to please write it. So they're getting the writing skills in. So they're beginning to do extended writing that's effective. And the nice thing about it, they love the movies. So if you just show it, it doesn't work. But if you do a guided showing, it's a phenomenal technique. Mm-hmm. And parents do this at home. I've had many parents that I work with do it like a once a week event where several, as long as everybody gets along and isn't going to overtalk everybody else, the whole family enjoys this experience.
Yeah, I can see that. And so you're building writing skills and not just the reading part of it. Or you're kind of taking the reading out of it, but still you're developing writing skills.
And also the language discussion that is very much like reading, you know.
Yeah.
But getting people to one of the things I do when I teach teachers is to show them how the overuse of specific questions is so bad, I'll say to them things like, okay, I'm going to teach you about this room. What color are the walls? And they say, whatever, blue. And I say, good. Do you see any windows here? They say, yes. How many? 4. Okay. What do people do with windows? Well, they open and close. Okay. Are there any people in this room? Yes. Fine. Are there any animals in this room? No. Okay. Oh, I said, good. You've answered every question correctly. Now you fully understand this room. And they realize that you understand nothing because there are a series of disconnected questions that happen to just be associated with the room, but they're not revealing anything about the room. It is really important to understand what you want out of a passage, out of a book or whatever. And one of the most important things you really, it's the key is getting to the main idea. And then the important details will associate themselves with the main idea. Another way I show it, because it isn't simply that we're not doing it, it's we're doing all the wrong things. And so, for example, for some reason, I don't know why, When Harry Met Sally is one of the most popular movies that everyone has seen. That's what I'm like.
I'm sorry about that.
Oh, okay.
That normally does not happen. Okay.
Okay. So I'd say to them, okay, you all saw it. Okay. You all saw When Harry Met Sally, right? Okay, I'm going to test you on it. What was the color of Sally's dress in the first scene? And everybody starts laughing. And I say, but that's exactly the kind of question you ask kids when you say, what was the color of the monkey's hat when the kids saw him in the zoo?
Right.
And so one learning disabled child who was really very bright gave me such insight. All the kids give me insights into this. But one day I'm doing the main idea with him. And he's clearly uncomfortable. He says, what are you doing? And I said, I'm just doing what they do in school all the time when they ask you for the main idea. He says, the main idea? He says, 8 out of 10 questions are details. I can still get an 80% correct score, he says, without ever understanding the main idea. He says, I don't understand the main idea, and I have no intention of ever learning because I don't know what it is.
Oh, yeah.
So we really must reteach. Get really new methods for teaching comprehension. What we're doing now is disastrous, and kids are really held up by this. Now, another thing that's really important and something that parents can do is there is a tendency when parents read to children, particularly young children, for them to use appealing stories with characters in them, you know, like Eeyore and Winnie the Pooh or whatever. And they're great. But we should introduce that it's long been known that knowledge base is absolutely central to effective comprehension. So that if, for example, a child reads that the Civil War began in 1861 because of the divisions between the North and the South, and he doesn't know what the Civil War is, and he doesn't know what 1861 was. The whole thing, even if he can read it perfectly well, he won't understand it.
So it's
really important to build a knowledge base. And one of the best ways and easiest ways is to make sure that you use in your readings to kids in the evening what's called expository or informational texts. In other words, books about volcanoes, books about the trip to the moon, books about even the marathon races. In other words, books that tell interesting stories, but they're much more sophisticated. And the other thing is expository text, meaning you're exposing an idea, is very differently organized from narratives. And so if a child doesn't have that background, they can't follow it when it comes up in school. So you can, or when it comes up in the curriculum, it doesn't matter if it's in school or at home.
Right.
So it's really important to expand the range of books that you read with children. And it depends on the family. Let's say a child for a while till he gets to know it doesn't want this, then you want it. So you trade off with the child. This week, it's your book. This week, I'll read my book, you know, kind of thing. Right. It shouldn't be, if you shove it down their throat and make it test-like, it'll be very counterproductive.
Right. Yeah. You can appease them to a certain point on what they like. And yet, you know, I always looked at ways to take what they liked and parts of that out of it. So like my son liked Legos and he loved these books all about Legos. Well, you know, then there's ways to go off of that, to go into like bridge building and engineering and, you know, other things like that. So there's ways to make those connections so that they kind of still have an interest in it, but you can move towards more books in that realm.
Yeah. And American, lots of comedians make jokes about how limited knowledge of Americans, but Americans tend to have a very poor knowledge base as a nation. And it's really, if you cannot have a democracy if you do not have an informed nation. So it's critical, not just to reading comprehension, it's critical to our country.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And yeah, we see history repeats itself, but if you don't know history, you won't know you're repeating it.
Right.
So we talked about some of the key components. You talked about decoding and comprehension.
Yeah.
What else is involved in the reading process? And I think we tend to undersimplify it. I think that's what you had said already.
Yeah.
Reading is very complex, and it's not something that we can just pick up a curriculum and say, oh, this is going to solve all my child's problems. And especially if they're a struggling reader, there's a lot more involved, isn't there?
Well, one of the things I've tried to do in Reading Kingdom and in ASD Reading is put in as many of those components as possible, because I think the reason some of the difficulties that we have, the reasons for those difficulties are that the teaching methods that have been used have been very inadequate and people have been forced to accept them. For example, people notice, and they've commented, you know, kids write letters backwards, they can't distinguish B and D and so on. But in fact, the situation is that the only activity, the only human activity that requires left to right sequencing is reading.
Yes.
And so when a child is not reading or has not been read to, they use the visual processes for everyday vision, which is a very different scanning process. And they get no help in visual sequencing. There's a very famous neuroscientist called Dehane who noticed about this. He comments, he writes quite a bit about this. And he says, well, it often takes children up to 10 years of age till they learn how to sequence properly. But in fact, that's because no one ever teaches it. We've built it into our Reading Kingdom program. And people often ask us why we do it, because they're so unfamiliar with it. And it's now, for example, we could do more and we hope to do it in future work. For example, if a teacher or an adult sees a child struggling to keep on the lines of reading, they'll say to the child, use your finger. Have you ever heard that?
Oh, yes, I have.
In fact, that's a very destructive technique. Because what happened, because what it does is it basically says the child's eye can't track. And instead of teaching the eye to track, they're using the hand to compensate. Now, if with only a few weeks of training, you can instead, for example, put a white card under the line of print so that the child sees only one line of print. And then he has to use his eyes, not his finger, but now he's not looking at the whole page. Then you can gradually build him up to handle two lines of print, then three lines of print. I mean, there are a number of techniques that go into it, but within 2 months, you can have him reading fluently with his own eye movements. If he's using his hand, he will almost never get really smooth eye movements and smooth, fast reading. And you want smooth, fast reading. So that's just one example. So ideally, we should have much better curriculum developers who are doing much better work so that the parents don't have to do it all and the teachers don't have to do it all. Another thing, for example, and this is, again, one of the features built in to Reading Kingdom. In school, in traditional curriculum, they don't require punctuation generally until third grade. They think it's okay because it's not that important. And so let's let the kids learn to read and then we'll introduce it. But in fact, what they've done is allow the children for 2 or 3 years to essentially read without punctuation and develop all kinds of reading that's independent of punctuation. Then you say to the child, now start attending to punctuation. He doesn't know what you're talking about. It's sort of like taking a person who's never spoken Chinese and he's now 10 years of age and you say, now you're going to speak Chinese, you lost the chance.
Right.
So
yeah,
a lot can be done. We know unfortunately, because phonics controls the field and so dominates what's going on, that these, I don't want to call them ancillary, these equally important alternative methods are just never come up. So what we need is really for the powers that be. I don't think the curriculum agencies will do it because they're making a lot of money doing what they're doing. I think the government has to really get in people who are not just phonics supporters and really begin to develop a much more enhanced reading curriculum than currently exists. In the meantime, parents, particularly homeschooling parents, need as much help as they can get in filling in the gaps that are not there. Yes. So if people would like to ask them.
Is introducing your children to text, then taking text out of a book that has all the punctuation in it versus a reading program, it would actually be more beneficial
And you can, one of the things you can do, for example, I used to do, now we have our program set up so it has it, but is to give the child, and one of the things children do learn, and if you watch children, you see the kind of error patterns they develop. If they finally have to learn punctuation, they do it for the first sentence on the page, and that's it. They put a capital at the start. They put a period somewhere where they think a period belongs, and that's the end of punctuation. In fact, it's really helpful to take relatively short paragraphs, 3 or 4 sentences, and present them with no capitals and no period, no punctuation, and say to the child, now punctuate it. And if the child gets it wrong, you show him he's allowed to find the error, and then he starts again. And one of the amazing things about human learning is if you teach well, you don't lose it. You really hold it. One of the things that I'm really proudest about Reading Kingdom is people tell me they don't get the summer slump. Everywhere else, if you don't keep up things during the summer, the children lose it. But if you teach with the right patterns, the children don't lose it. And so I think the potential is enormous but unfortunately, it's not happening.
Right, because we switch between. The thing that I hear the most is a parent uses one reading program. This isn't working, so then they switch to another one. This isn't working, so they switch to another one. And the kid is so confused by the time you get to the third or fourth curriculum that they don't even know what they're learning other than trying to just put sounds together and read what's on a page.
Yeah.
And
one of the things that is really important is to prevent error. Allow some error, but if a child has failed at a reading program, it means his experience is I'm no good, and that is that is something you really want to avoid.
They can hit that slide pretty quick. Their self worth and how well they can do anything. One of our viewers said that she has, one of her boys is hyperlexic. You had talked about that earlier. And Amy commented, love the idea about highlighting. We talked about different ways for doing eye tracing. And she had also stated that phonics is not always the answer. I have another question from one of our viewers that I want to get to right when we get back from, we're going to take a little break to hear from our sponsor. And then we're going to come back and address her question and then continue this conversation.
Okay, fine.
Okay. All right. So So our sponsor tonight is Bookshark, and I'm going to share with you a little bit about their curriculum so that you can get to know them better. I know they've sponsored some other broadcasts in the past, and the people that have been on the broadcast have been ecstatic about them being one of our sponsors as well as one of our partner organizations. But they are a literature-based 4-day faith-neutral curriculum. And Kim McNeary, a busy homeschool mom, said, my daughter's on the spectrum as well as has OCD and has instantly taken this curriculum. It's incredibly structured. The books are great. The kits are awesome. And I'm running my daughter to all kinds of appointments. And this curriculum fits in amazingly. We're a first-year Bookshark customer and happy as a lark. Kim is right. Bookshark's fully planned 4-day homeschool curriculum flexes to meet your busy lifestyle. The detailed instructor's guide lay everything out clearly. It's a prepared teacher guide. You just open it, gather your resources, and go. They have curriculum for ages 4 to 16 in all subject areas that you can either buy by package or individual academic areas. It's reading with history, language, arts, science, and math. With Bookshark's Literature Rich program, your children will read or have books read to them, 35 to 50 engaging books a year. So visit bookshark.com and browse their curriculum. Plus, they have free downloads and samples for you to look at. So thank you, Bookshark, again for sponsoring this episode. We appreciate that. And now we're going to head back to bring our guest up again. And we have Dr. Marion Blank with us. And she is talking to us about reading comprehension and how that leads to academic success. And I know a lot of the first part of our conversation was just the complexity and some of the things that we do that make it even more complex than we really should. And she's been bringing up, if you don't know what Reading Kingdom is or ASD Reading, which she's talked about a lot, there are two different reading programs that she's developed. They're both partner organizations with us, SPED Homeschool. You'll find them on our website. I'll also include links if you're watching this on YouTube. You'll see the links on the YouTube video as well as you'll see them on this broadcast. And so, and if you're listening to this on the podcast, just go to our YouTube channel and search for the equivalent video and you'll find all that information. Can't put links in there, unfortunately. But welcome back, Dr. Marion.
Hi.
And so one of the questions I want to get started with is from one of our guests. And she said, can you address teaching reading to a child who's nonverbal and learning to use AAC? There's very little curriculum for this population.
Well, I'd like this, the person who wrote in or called in to comment if she can. AAC, I have never seen with autistic population it used for anything but I want behavior. And is it possible for you to ask the person who asked the question? Could you ask her how it's being used in her life?
Right. So how are you using that, the AAC? I know next month we're going to focus two whole episodes on AAC. It is actually AAC, National AAC Month. And we're going to be talking about just working with nonverbal. I'm not an expert, so I can't tell you. But when she shares that, we'll definitely include that question in. So you were talking a little bit about...
No, I'd like to go back to it until we get the answer.
Yes, yes.
So the thing is, I and it's in my book, Spectacular Bond, I am very... It's not that I'm against. It's that I know that the encouragement of I want language is very destructive ultimately. It does not teach the child. I have never, having seen thousands of kids, ever seen it generalized beyond I want. And there's a good reason, because I want is a form of initiation, but it's a form of initiation that never has to take into account anything but what the child wants. He doesn't have to think of the person. He doesn't have to think of the setting. He doesn't have to think of anyone else's needs. It's just what he wants. And then what happens is you, because you're saying, oh my God, I'll give him what he wants and then he's going to love me and then he's going to do what I want. They will be partners. It doesn't work that way. It's fine. You give me what I want, but I have no intention of giving you what you want. And I've gotten, when I wrote an article on this in the Huffington Post a number of years ago, I had people writing me, one woman in Australia in particular. She says, it's exactly what happened to my daughter is now 15. And if she doesn't get what she wants, she has explosive rage episodes because she was always given what she wanted. And so I do not like, you don't need AAC for I want. You could have, if you're going to want the child to indicate certain, you can just have some pictures. You don't need AAC. I have seen AAC used very effectively with other populations. For example, if you have a child with cerebral palsy who's deeply motivated to communicate, the AAC is a great tool, depending on which ones you use. That is not the case with children with autism. Now, what I have done, the interesting thing is, and it's not being studied, is that non-speaking, I much prefer the term non-speaking to non-verbal, because all the children are verbal. But anyway, what's called the non-verbal child is very keen and skilled at learning written language. I have seen them produce levels of language that are far superior to what any of the kids are producing in spoken language. They have a real, they have a tremendous ability. I remember one child I was working with in Alabama, and he, one of the reasons people sometimes get upset with my technique is we use hand support, not hand over hand. Hand support, because the children have poor motor skills and the hand support stabilizes them. So anyway, at one point where he was totally able to write on his own and did not need hand support. So I said to him, I said, look, you can write totally on your own. This is how I spoke to him. He was 7 or 8. I said, you can write totally. Why do you insist on your mother holding your hand? And he typed out, don't ask. And that's amazing pragmatic language for children on the spectrum. So if you're willing to spend the time and effort to teach them how to use a computer and the keyboard, either a screen keyboard or the regular keyboard, you can develop very effective language skills. Now, some of the kids can really start learning to type quickly. Others have motor problems and can't. But I do not see limiting a child to an AAC device when, if you give him spoken language, when you give him written language, he can both read anything and write anything. And there's no, I mean, the boundaries are so much greater. And if you read some of the books that are coming out from children who have been nonverbal and on the spectrum, they're writing beautiful pieces of literature. Now, people start saying, oh, they didn't really write it. And so, but I know enough kids who've done this to know that at least a good part of them are doing it. And their capacity to learn a full functioning language system is there. And AAC doesn't take advantage of it.
Hmm. Yeah, she had said that her son is using it mostly for requests. I want personal information, name, address, and describe pain levels. So basic information.
Yeah. But you could get him into real language, which is what the kids enjoy. What it also does is it enables them to understand the world better. They suddenly can understand what people are saying to one another. And that greatly limits or eases their anxiety, which is something people don't talk about. But can you imagine living in a world where people are essentially speaking Chinese and you don't understand a word of what's going on? You just tune out. It encourages the tuning out that the children show. Whereas once they understand it, they just feel much more comfortable, even if they're not contributing to the conversation. They just feel, oh, I see what they're talking about. That's okay. Yeah. So it'd be interesting if you have a chance to ask this parent, why is she not using a full reading program rather than an AAC device?
Yeah. Well, I think her question is, how do I get there? I know even for my son that was on the spectrum, reading was difficult. And we did a lot of, read alouds. We did a lot of audio books, but we also acted out.
That's great. Yes.
Because the social aspect of understanding cause and effect, even when they heard the words, didn't make sense.
That's right.
And so if we were to put our body into it and all of a sudden see, oh, when I do this, this is what happens to the other person. And it's that social, emotional piece.
That's a wonderful,
brings in. And that adds to their understanding as well. There's like you said when we started, there's so many components involved in this that we just stick with the text and learning to read the text, we're missing the larger picture of what reading is about. So I know one of the questions that we were going to talk about a little bit about was comprehension in the rest of the world versus the U.S. Is that based on what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong, and what do we have to learn based on those differences.
Yeah. These are always controversial. There are big international studies, and then people say, well, the United States really isn't 28th, it's only 24th, you know, and they have these discussions. But basically, the United States, out of all the developed countries, comes out among the worst in math and in reading. And in my view, there are several factors. One is that we have increasing rates of poverty, dramatically increasing rates of poverty in the last decade. And poverty, we know, is associated with all kinds of trauma, with all kinds of difficulty, and with all kinds of poor school achievement. It's, if you're poor and struggling, it's very hard. Now, what's also, the way our setup is in the United States exacerbates that. For example, Finland doesn't have the rates of poverty that we do, but they have a wide variance from rich to poor. But in Finland, the funding is from the federal government and every school is given equal support. In the United States, the funding is local. And the poorer the county or the poorer the district, the less the funds. So that children from poor areas get very poor schooling. Children from rich areas get rich schooling because their community supports it. And if people live in an area where for some reason they're rich people and they can't get the funds to the schools, let's say in New York City where it's controlled by other, then they go to private schools. So we have too many children in schools that are underfunded and poorly staffed with the teachers with the least experience and so on and so forth.
We're seeing a rise in the homeschooling population, especially among special education, because the funding there is getting worse. Well, it's the same amount of funding, but more kids.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
So what do you do? You bring them home because you don't want them to be the statistic that finally tipped the school into making something change.
Yeah. The other thing is that our curricula are very weak. Our reading curricula are really extremely weak, and we are constantly failing the children. It's really interesting. There are lots and lots of discussions. It's been on National Public Radio. It's been in The Atlantic. It's been in Washington Post. It's been in New York Times, that we must do more phonics teaching. That's the reason it's poor. And one of the things that people don't recognize, the phonics wars, or the wars in reading, started many decades back. And actually, I was a student of one of the leaders in that whole discussion, Jean Scholl, and she wrote a book on the Great Debate. I forgot the first vote. It was the Great Debate in Reading. And she said, well, phonics is better than the literature-based, so we really ought to support phonics. What has not been said and must be said is that, yes, literature-based instruction for the most part has been less good than phonics, but phonics has been a disaster. It has steadily caused, since records have been kept in the 1960s, and the National Educational Panel, which presents the records every 2 years, across the nation, the average percentage of children who do not have proficient reading is about 65%.
Wow.
So that we are failing the majority. We have a massive epidemic of failure. People, I've discussed this sometimes with principals, and they don't believe me until I show them. They said, it can't be that bad. But the failure rate is basically 65%. The massive failure rate, where you have almost no reading whatsoever, is 40%.
Wow.
Now, what adds to all the problems in the United States is, unfortunately, fortunately or unfortunately, the fact that we speak English. English is not a language that lends itself to traditional phonics. For example, there was recently a broadcast on NPR, National Public Radio, and they were saying to the children, this was in Arkansas, why are you doing so well now? He says, well, I learned to put a sound on every letter. Well, in actual fact, in English, fewer than 20% of the words can you put a sound on every letter. So what we do within a few months of them starting is start teaching them rules upon rules upon rules. The good reader never has to learn the rules because they bypass them. And the poor reader can't understand the rules. And the rules don't hold. So we have got to develop a better, definitely we have to teach children how to look at letters and decode them. But we must have a system better than phonics. I think that system is available through visual memory. But that was tossed out years ago. Visual memory is amazingly powerful. And if you teach it right, the ability of people to see the patterns of words is much greater than their ability to apply the rules that they're being told to apply. So we do have very strong evidence of what we should be doing, and we're not doing it.
Or the one gal who's been giving us some questions, Nietzsche, said that the public school teacher said she just didn't know how to teach him. Private school has had him learning sounds. So I think she's basically saying, you know, what you've been talking about. The teachers don't know how to teach.
No.
And then they're teaching him phonics. There are other ways. I know, like I told you, when I first started homeschooling, I didn't even know what phonics was.
Yeah.
It's not how I was taught to read. I learned whole word memorized, you know, I could decode enough. I didn't even know what that word meant either, but I knew I could do it. And, you know, I made it through college. So it worked.
Yeah, whole word worked almost as well, not quite as well as phonics. The thing is, you see, there's even one of the major phonics proponents, Louisa Moats, who believes in it fervently. And she said there are about, her estimate is 60%. Mine would be a little bit less. There are about 60% of kids who will learn to read whatever system you use. It's the 40 or 50% that are not going to do that, and we've got to develop ways for them. And that's the group that keeps saying we must have phonics. And then there has been a development which is worth discussing. What happened in the 1960s is everybody recognized that phonics was kind of hard and not very successful. So they said, you know what? We need something before phonics. We need the kids to realize how to take apart words. They don't know how to take apart words in speaking. Like if you hear the word cat, you just think of cat. You don't hear a bunch of different sounds.
Right.
And they said, no, but for reading, they've got to hear these different sounds. So what we've got to do is teach children how to analyze the sounds of words. And that became known as phonological awareness or phonemic awareness, which is now a dominating system. There was recently a review by a very famous reading scientist, Max Coltart, in Australia. No, it was an English, no, it was someone at Harvard, at Oxford, sorry. But there was a review by this well-known scientist at Oxford. Out of the thousands of studies on phonological awareness done throughout the world, there is not one that shows that it helps reading.
Wow.
Do the phonological awareness people say we got to change it? Oh, no, they just keep insisting they're right. So it's, you know, when a system gets in and gets hold of it doesn't let go, even though it is clearly not doing its, I mean, they've had now decades, 5 to 6 decades to prove that this helps. Mm. It doesn't help. And there isn't one study that shows it helps. And yet it's mandated by the federal government that every program must teach it.
Yeah, it's who yells the loudest and the longest usually that ends up doing that, unfortunately. We've got a couple of comments here from Amy. She was saying how she had taught her son to read, and he now reads 1 to 2 levels above grade level, and I know her son is on the autism spectrum. And she said some kids just can't hear phonological awareness tasks like my son.
Oh, of course not. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And hyperlexia. I spoke to one of the leaders of the phonological movement years ago, a really famous person. And I said to her, you know, have you ever seen a hyperlexic kid? And she said, what are they? And I said, well, these are kids who don't speak very well usually, don't have good comprehension, but can decode anything. And I said, I've never seen one of them do it with phonological principles. I said, says, well, I've never seen one. And she walked away. Basically, it's like she was saying, I don't believe in black swans. I hold up a black swan. She said, well, I don't believe in black swans. Bye. So people are very committed to what they're committed to and aren't interested in changing, which is really unfair. The big thing with children with autism, usually decoding is not a problem. It is really good, though, to teach them comprehension, and they have trouble with comprehension. And it's very good to teach them higher level writing skills because they really blossom with that. They can do it, but they need help and structure to do it.
Right. And I love the example you shared at the beginning with, you know, just using the video or just describing a room that you're in.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many ways that you can take the text out of it and still be able to teach writing with descriptions and realizing what writing truly is. And it's not a bunch of answers to questions. Something more. The one question that I want to make sure that we get to, you had said something about fourth grade. Why is fourth grade reading so central to academic success?
Well, because it's, first of all, we don't do national measures on reading until fourth grade. So that's, so we don't even have the figures below that. But it's generally thought that teachers should be allowed to teach kids to learn to read up till fourth grade. First, second, third grade should be on learning to read. And then at fourth grade, it becomes reading to learn. In other words, you're now taking material from books and you're using it to expand your knowledge base, to expand your analysis of ideas, to really grow intellectually. And what happens is this very solid, unfortunately, solid data that if a child is not reading well by fourth grade, he will almost certainly never read well. There are exceptions. Fortunately, there's never a totally closed door. But for the vast majority of children, if they're not reading well by fourth grade, nothing then happens to get them to read well. They just get more and more books at higher and higher levels. And so they never catch up. They are just always at a very low level.
It gets bigger. As a homeschooler, we can hold back.
That's right.
Or we can somehow, you know, be able to read to them so that doesn't get in the way of them. But in a standard classroom, yes, they can get lost very quickly.
Yeah. And so, and now, unfortunately, there's actually a move on, I hope it doesn't succeed, to say literacy is unimportant. We're in a post-literacy age. We had that for a couple hundred years, but now we're in the digital age and we don't need reading. And there's absolutely no reason why the two systems can't coexist. I would never throw out the digital world. It's a phenomenal world, the whole AI world. But to throw out literacy is massive insanity. And people are trying to do it because it'll mean they can cut school budgets and they can save a lot of money. And we'll have just, you know, the 5% of kids who go to Harvard and Yale be literate, and who cares about the rest? And it's a disaster if we do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's a thinking skill.
Of course.
We often don't think about how much our reading and writing cause us to mentally process in a completely different way.
Yeah.
So that we can understand and throw ideas around that we just can't through normal conversation sometimes. We have to be able to do that.
And there's good research showing that writing, good writing, I don't mean writing the alphabet, but that good writing really develops higher level thinking skills, delaying skills, analysis skills, because to write an effect. And I'll just mention one of the techniques parents may find useful. I've seen teachers do this very well, is to take, the children have to be pretty good readers at this level, at least fifth or sixth grade. You give them samples of different types of writing. It could be Mark Twain, it could be Jane Austen, whatever. And you give them a paragraph and ask them to create a paragraph in that style.
Oh,
and it is amazingly thought-provoking and to, it's almost like an artist being told, here's a Van Gogh, try and copy it. Well, he's not going to become Van Gogh, but he's going to learn an awful lot about art. And this is the same thing. If you, instead of just saying to the child, come up with your own ideas, say, here's a writer. Try and follow, and you learn a tremendous amount that way. Writing is a phenomenal skill, and we don't do enough of it in school.
But so, yeah, I love how we've kind of woven that into this topic of talking about your reading comprehension, but writing is so key. And I know when we had talked about questions ahead of time, you said, bring up writing.
That's right.
Because it's so important.
Yes, it is.
And I think oftentimes we limit kids who struggle with reading to not to add in those writing things. I know I'm guilty of that one with definitely my oldest. My middle child wanted to write even though he couldn't read.
And that's
so we
great.
Had to find different ways to help him to do that. But it's one of those things that they really causes them to press on in a skill that you need them both, but you can develop them separately. And I love the ideas you shared with us. So is there anything else you want to share with our parents as we're kind of wrapping up on just reading comprehension and encouragement if their child is struggling and where to go from here?
Well, I don't mind. Maybe another time, but we have very little time right now, but it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and we're doing a repeat performance. So next month, Dr. Marion Blank is going to be joining me on October 22nd, and we're going to be talking about enhancing language in all children with autism. So we're going to specifically be talking about autism and language skills. And our whole topic next month, you get a kind of a sneak peek of October, we're going to be talking about communication and different types of communication, social communication, and interactive communication, relational communication, but also that topic with you. And so I'm excited about doing another hour because this went very quickly and you are just a wealth of information.
Well, thank you.
I appreciate all that you had to share with us tonight. And thank you for joining us on this broadcast. We definitely appreciate you joining us live because your questions are wonderful to add into this. It's not just questions that I need to ask, but just whatever you have to bring to ask our guest. We appreciate this. So, but this broadcast is partially sponsored by viewers like you who donate to Sped Homeschool on our website, as well as our sponsor tonight, who is Bookshark. And we just want to thank them again for sponsoring this episode. Let's keep the conversation going. You can join our support group here on Facebook where we talk about special education and homeschooling all week long. And then we come back and do this broadcast again on Tuesday. AG says, thank you so much. And Amy says, thank you both. Wonderful presentation. And thank you, Bookshark, for sponsoring. Yes. So, thank you for your time, Marion. We appreciate you. And next week we are talking to Michael Maloney again. And we're going to talk about how direct instruction helps parents to teach struggling readers. So we're going to be talking about that. But thanks, everyone, for joining us. We appreciate it. And I'll see you right here again next week. Bye, everyone.
Bye.